This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, October 30th, Mischief Night Day. And this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton, Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Denise Coffey from the Cape Cod Times, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford. We'll hear from George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times and Mike Dean at the State House. Town clerks across the region have been working overtime as we head into next Tuesday's general election. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us with that story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Jeanette, you were in Edgartown this week where you stopped by the town clerk's office. This has been an unprecedented election for local town clerks with all the options for voting. Tell us, what did you see and hear there?
Well, at that time, it was pretty quiet. It was kind of midday on a weekday when I was at town hall there in Edgartown. I didn't see anyone vote in person, but I did see a few people dropping off their ballots coming by, either some of them on foot or on bicycle. But the town clerk said overall, even though it was slow at that moment, it has been very busy for the early voting. At that point, and this was Tuesday, 44% of the town's registered voters had already voted. And she said people also seem to be really upbeat about voting, happy to be casting their vote, and happy to have so many different options for doing that. We should note, though, that today is actually the last day of early voting across the state. So if you don't do it today, Friday, then you need to wait till Election Day.
So 44% had cast their ballots by Tuesday in Edgartown. Is that mostly mail-in voting or kind of split between mail-in voting and early voting? Did you get any numbers on that?
It was almost half and half. One group was 1,000, the other was 800 and something, I think. So fairly evenly split.
Now, there is a lot of energy and passion around this upcoming election, and in some ways it has the potential to overlap with Halloween. That was the message from public officials this week. You reported on this. Tell us what you heard.
The police chief in Chatham, Mark Paulina, talked about this week. He said that he does have some concerns, even though the town doesn't usually see too much of this, but because of the kind of pent-up energy people have from isolation with the pandemic and with emotions running very high about the election, he's a little concerned about vandalism this year around Halloween. So patrols are going to be watching for that, and he pointed out in particular they're going to be watching to make sure that ballot drop-off box stays secure throughout the weekend.
And some of the police departments have been involved in Halloween candy giveaways, and this year it sounds like some are doing that and some aren't.
Right. So, yes, some departments are doing what they call the reverse Halloween, where they're coming by to children's homes with a little bag, a little goodie bag of candy and such. Chatham decided not to do that. The chief said they normally do a Halloween event with another group in the community, but they decided not to, just out of an abundance of caution, really, because he said if, you know, even one person gets COVID-19 because of an activity that they put on, that's too many. So in Chatham, they decided not to do it. But I know a lot of communities are having different types of events that are designed to be, what they believe is safe.
Now, Jeanette, earlier this week, we saw a spike in COVID cases in Barnstable. Tell us what we know about these.
Right. So the numbers have come down a little bit since then. But on Monday and Tuesday, we had new case counts for Cape Cod in the mid-20s. And we have not seen that since May. Senator Julian Sear said the majority of those cases are connected to an indoor gathering that happened somewhere on the mid-Cape where people were not wearing masks indoors. He said it was a pretty small gathering, but that people who went to that then came home and infected their family members. So those folks are all kind of included in that count. Yeah, he said it's just kind of another reminder that, like, it doesn't have to be some sort of a wild party in order for people to be transmitting this stuff. It could be something as simple as a meeting, just, you know, but if it's indoors without masks, that's kind of the bad combination. And I noticed there was a little bit this week, a shift in the language of the reopening task force about community spread. So for a long time, they've been saying there's really little to no evidence of community spread. And this week, the expression was there's not much evidence of community spread. And Sears said he's expecting that eventually the increase in cases statewide will reach Cape Cod if, you know, things continue on the trend we're seeing now.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
A new report finds there are far fewer right whales alive than previously predicted. CAI's Sam Houghton joins us now with that story and more. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Sam, tell us about this report. Who put it out, and what does it tell us about this endangered whale population?
Yeah, I mean, take away more dismal news for right whales, but this was put out by NOAA, or the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. They say that as of 2019, there are only 366 right whales alive. Before this, it's kind of been widely reported there are about 400 of the whales alive. So this is far fewer than what was known. I don't think this came as like as a big surprise for those who have been really following this closely, but still, it's not good news. The study also found there were only about 90 breeding females believed to be alive as well. And kind of also important here, these are numbers from 2019. We know of 10 other whales that have died since then. There are still others that have been, you know, badly injured that will likely die soon as well. So it's more like 350 that are alive. Researchers have been saying this for a while now, but the species, you know, it's really in critical shape and really are on the verge of extinction. For context here, 100 right whales have died over the last 5 years. So one advocate I spoke with, you know, says that it could be extinct within the next 30 or 40 years unless the federal government really takes steps immediately here.
Well, what are those steps that advocates are calling for in response to this news?
Yeah, so I spoke with this group called the Conservation Law Foundation. They're a Boston Environmental Action Group. They filed a lawsuit against federal fisheries managers calling for protections for the whales. That was in 2018. And as part of that lawsuit, the federal government has to release new guidelines for fishermen. And the deadline for those to go into effect is next spring, but we still don't know what they will look like. I talked with Erica Fuller at the foundation. They thought those would be released in September, but that obviously hasn't happened yet. So with the release of this new report, you know, with just 360 whales left, she's asking for immediate action to be taken while those long-term solutions come out. I guess the main threats here to right whales, I should say, or really whales in general, are ship strikes and entanglements in fishing gear. So the Law Foundation wants mandatory speed restrictions for boaters in waters where there are known to have right whales. They also want fishing gear removed from areas where the whales are frequent. And they want better markings for fishing equipment. A lot of the time when a whale gets entangled in fishing line, researchers really have no idea where that gear came from. So we'll see where that goes, but you know, I think the underlying message here is that it, you know, more bad news for right whales.
Sam, also this week, a local environmental group released its assessment of water quality in the Cape's ponds and bays. This too was more not so good news.
Yeah, quite a week. So this was from the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. It announced its second annual State of the Waters report. I think the big takeaway from this report is the degree of problems for freshwater ponds. We know that estuaries in the Cape are in rough shape. We've known that for a long time. And this report certainly highlights that, but even shows it might even be getting worse. But there has been there hasn't been as much attention about freshwater ponds really until recently. And that report found that 42% of the ponds they sampled had poor water quality standards. So nearly every other freshwater pond on the Cape. Like estuaries, they've been inundated with high levels of nitrogen. And the big problem with ponds is algae blooms called cyanobacteria. Kind of our own Eve Zuckoff had a series on the blue-green algae bloom last week. Basically, the blooms are becoming more problematic. We even reported on someone on the vineyard who got sick. And Andrew Gottlieb is the executive director of the association. He says that ponds might be worse than what they reported. He says there just isn't enough data to know the extent of the problem. And Andrew Gottlieb, he's calling on the Cape Cod Commission to conduct an investigation of the ponds, much like has been done for Cape Estuary.
That is CAI Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Dave.
The 2020 lobster stock assessment for southern New England is out, and it's not a good report. But vineyard lobstermen surprisingly seem to be having strong seasons. Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette has this story and joins us now. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, let's start with the report. What does it say?
The report, which is done by the ASNFC, which is this interstate fishing regulatory agency along the entire Atlantic coast, says that lobster stocks in southern New England, which pretty much runs from south of New York up to Nantucket in the South Cape, are significantly depleted, which basically means that they've reached their lowest levels on record and that there, you know, basically is not a great hope of recovery for the stock. So it's a fairly grim report. And the way they conduct it is kind of interesting. They basically use catch reports and then survey and trawling data. And what it showed was that now, the southern New England lobster stock has really declined since basically the late 90s. And at the same time, the Gulf of Maine lobster stock, which is pretty much from the, you know, south part of the Cape up north all the way to Maine, is seeing a historic boom. And there are some reasons for that. But basically, it's an interesting contrast between the southern stock declining and the northern stock doing very well.
Are we looking at warming waters? Is that one of the big issues they think is at play here?
That is what the scientists say. If you think about it, the Gulf of Maine doing better and the southern part of the lobster stock doing worse would suggest that that's true. Lobster like cooler waters. Talking to one of the scientists who did the assessment, he said that sort of the 12 to 18 degrees Celsius range is like the golden zone. And then once it starts to get above 20 degrees Celsius, it becomes a stressful condition for lobsters. And he was saying that in a lot of parts of the southern New England fishery, there are now, you know, at least, you know, 80 to 100 days of the year where water temperatures are above 20 degrees Celsius, and that is something that just, it doesn't bode well for species reproduction. And they think that it also is having an impact on shell disease, which can really affect how the lobsters reproduce and how they molt, and can be a struggle for the, it in general is causing problems for the species and for its overall health. So yes, they definitely think water temperature is a factor. The lobsters in the vineyard think.
Yeah. So now I want to ask you about the vineyard, because the vineyard is kind of an exception here.
Yeah. Well, one thing to note is that the vineyard and Nantucket and sort of these areas a little bit farther east and north, they're on the northern or on the northern end of the southern New England lobster region. So when they're doing this whole stock assessment, you're getting numbers from Cape, you're getting numbers from the Long Island Sound, even south of that. And so the water temperature here can be very different from the water temperature there. With that being said, though, vineyard lobstermen, They noted that they've been having really good catches in recent years, that the lobster are in general healthy. I mean, some of them were noting that there was an increase in shell disease. But in general, they were saying that the fisheries around here are doing well. And they expressed some skepticism about whether the decline in the lobster stock in southern New England is due to water temperature. You know, they were saying factors like DDT spraying and mosquito repellent were also something that could be at play for the shell disease issue, which was really interesting to hear. And it's interesting to see how sort of, you know, the scientific assessment can contrast what people are seeing on the water.
That said, your article points out that when they say they're doing well, it's actually all relative, that 20,
right.
30 years ago, doing well was a much bigger, you know, take for lobstermen
right.
around the vineyard.
Right, that's very true. You know, if you just look in the aggregate at the Southern New England catch data, which, of course, is not just the vineyard, but, you know, it's a much larger area than that, you know, the amount that it's declined is crazy. I mean, it's gone from, I think, 22 million pounds in catch were brought in the late 1990s, which was sort of the peak, by 28, it was 2.7 million pounds. So that's, you know, like 1,000% decrease, basically. You know, that basic, I think, you know, what might be happening if warming water temperatures are the issue, then what is happening in Long Island Sound could continue to happen further north as water temperatures warm, potentially hasn't happened yet. That's something the scientists were saying as well.
It's Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette. Oh, Noah, we have to leave it there. Noah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
The town of Chatham is taking a closer look at how it communicates with residents and businesses. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle has this story. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, there were some problems around communication about town projects that precipitated this. Is that right?
Yeah, a couple of recent instances where the town was criticized for the way it informed both residents and businesses about recent projects, particularly a sidewalk replacement project in the downtown area. The town had sent direct mail letters to property owners over the Columbus Day weekend in the affected area. But that information took a few days to trickle down to the tenants who don't own the property there. And, you know, officials agreed that it was kind of a failure to communicate in this instance. The same thing, a similar thing happened with the West Chatham Roadway project, which is now underway. There were a couple of instances where things weren't done the way they had been promised, and it was hard to get the two parties, the town and the people affected, to communicate. And these aren't the only instances. It's happened before in the past. And town manager Jill Goldsmith ran down the number of ways that the town can communicate with residents and businesses, you know, direct mail, the town's website. They have one of those reverse 911 phone systems through their cable channel and the local media. But right now, other than police, fire, and recreation department, the town has virtually no presence on social media, which, as we know, is kind of where a lot of people get their information these days. The police and fire sometimes put up town news, but there's no town dedicated Facebook account, for instance, or Twitter account. And the only way the town has of getting in touch with people via email is if they have already provided their email address through that reverse 911 system, which does both phone calls and email. Really, more importantly, Goldsmith said the town lacks the staff and time, you know, to handle social media, especially because with the open meeting law and the public records law, every post that's comes from a town source has to be archived. It's considered a public document. And right now there's just not the personnel or the mechanism to handle that. There was a proposal to add a staff person to do this in this current year's budget, but when the pandemic hit and the budget was revised, that staff proposal was put aside for now. But Selectman said they think that needs to be revisited. They see the communicating with residents and businesses as very important, and they're planning to reiterate that and see if they can get that staff position reconsidered. It had been opposed by the Finance Committee, so they said that they want to make it clear to the Finance Committee how much this is important for the town in its relationship with its residents and its businesses. Another suggestion was to make input to really bake into communications, to bake into project contracts a communications plan. That way there would be something already in place that the town could rely on and maybe be handled by a contractor instead of by a town person. Jill Goldsmith says she's going to go ahead and look into doing that in future contracts, and she's also intent on developing protocols for handling social media, email, and more upgraded communications. The town is about to upgrade its website, and she said that may help with some of these issues. So, you know, they're really trying to make an effort here to put in place something to improve communications, and selectmen were in a meeting this week, were really adamant about getting that done and improving the way that they deal with situations like this.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle with the story. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Cape Cod and the islands are seeing record-breaking growth in home sales. Denise Coffey of the Cape Cod Times has this story and joins us now. Hi, Denise.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Denise, there are a lot of numbers in the story, percentages of new listings and recent sales and median asking prices. Break it down for us a little bit here. Just how big is this real estate boom for home sales on the Cape?
Well, everyone I've talked to in the real estate field have said it's a crazy season. They've used the words insane, crazy, unbelievable. I think when the pandemic first hit, mid-March, people were a little concerned. Andrew Murray at Coldwell Banker, Martha Murray, was saying he was really nervous. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. This is a pandemic. It's the first time it's ever happened. But he said things turned around. And I think they were saying that in mid-April, I think right around tax day, there was a switch that just got flipped, and people were buying left and right. So people were getting their homes bought for sale price that they were being asked. That there were some bidding wars, though some of them were saying they'd rather call it multiple offers as opposed to bidding wars. But people were putting in offers left and right and sometimes driving the price of those homes up. So they said it's been unbelievable.
What do we know about who's buying these homes? Obviously, as you say, it seems to be the pandemic that's driving a lot of this. What do we know about who's buying the homes?
Well, if the median sales prices are $550 and above, now this is for the Cape. I mean, they're seeing record sales in Provincetown, Orleans, Chatham. Those are, you know, where the wealthier folks tend to go, according to the real estate agents I've spoken with. So those prices are higher. More of those are being sold, so it drives up the median prices across the Cape. So, you know, if you have $550,000 home sales, these are people who I think are coming from the cities. These are people maybe who have jobs where they can work remote. Their kids are going to school remotely. So not everybody who can spend $550,000 on a home.
I know at one point in your article, you talk about homes with wine cellars, and you think these are not just everyday homes necessarily.
No, they aren't. And that was, I think, Bill Marsh who said that. He says, and he's a builder. He's been a builder for 50 years on the Cape. And he was saying his business is going crazy. And these are people who, and that's another thing they were talking about. People are not just buying more homes, more expensive homes. The prices are going up. But people are working on the homes that they have. And he said he's been doing more renovations, putting in offices, wine cellars, you know, making space for gyms. The people who can adapt to the pandemic, who have the money to do it, are investing in their own homes to do it. He said it's the busiest he's ever been. Even building new houses. He says he didn't even have permits for five of them, and they were sold. You know, he's calling it insane as well.
Denise, there must be concerns that go along with this about how the Cape supports this kind of boom.
Well, yes, and that's why, you know, the president of Reef Builders, Matt Teague, was saying, You know, towns on the Cape have to deal with wastewater. They have to build infrastructure. You can't talk about density, building more homes, and building affordable homes. Remember, there are people who can't afford these expensive homes, and yet they work here, and we rely on them for so much. And it seems that these people are being forced into properties that you don't see. You don't see the inside. You don't see how they live. You don't see the space they have or the facilities they have. And the properties are being taken off the market. Those properties that some people who are lower income, working people, they can't afford them. And the ones they can afford are being taken off the market. And Matt was saying, hey, you know, the Cape has to address it. They have to address it so that people have affordable places to live, but also that we take care of our environment, because it's not just housing. We're talking coastal waters, freshwater ponds. These waters are impaired, and more of them are getting impaired, and that's not going to change if we keep building homes with the septic systems and leach fields, and that effluent isn't treated. And that's where we're drawing our water from, the same ground that we put our waste into. So Matt had some really interesting things to say. You know, the building permits are tough to get.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That's okay. We have to leave it there. Denise Coffey of the Cape Cod Times with the story of record-breaking growth in home sales across the region this fall. Denise, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Opposition is mounting to a major vertical expansion, potential vertical expansion of a downtown commercial building in Nantucket. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror is on the line now with that story. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, tell us about this building. It's an existing building, but the company that owns it wants to go higher.
They want to go up, right. It's a massive vertical expansion. A full third story has been proposed for the building on South Water Street that's right next to the historic Pacific Club, a three-story brick historic building. And it's drawn quite a bit of opposition in recent days. The plan does call for the addition of a full third floor to what's been a one-and-a-half-story building for more than 60 years. It houses a number of retail stores and an art gallery. And if approved by the Historic District Commission, the owner of the building, a Newton Development Company, plans to put residential units on the second and third floors of that building, which it bought in 1996 and was formerly home to a longtime home to a hardware store that went out of business when it was purchased. The Historic District Commission has been reviewing this proposal for several months, a couple of different meetings via Zoom with the constraints of coronavirus. And it had scheduled a special meeting for this morning to discuss only this proposal, but it was canceled late yesterday at the request of the applicant. Opponents who have gotten a little bit more vocal in recent weeks or recent days, really, including the directors of the Pacific Club building and members of the Historic District Commission's own Historic Structures Advisory Board, are saying that the scale is simply too imposing and it doesn't fit the character of the street and its surroundings. The plans call for a roof walk and multiple decks, balconies, and big dormers on the upper floors of the building, which totals about 7,100 square feet in the one and a half stories that it's in. The majority of the buildings around it are 1.5 to 2 stories in height. The Pacific Club is a three-story building. It was once the headquarters of William Roach, whose ships were involved in the Boston Tea Party. But even though it's three stories, a three-story addition next to it, its directors say, will really detract from the historic nature of the building and of the downtown neighborhood. They say it stands out, as do a couple of other three-story buildings in the area, because the rest of the buildings are smaller and really speak to the historic evolution of that part of the downtown district on Nantucket.
Josh, a Nantucket board had its online meeting hacked recently. Tell us about this.
That was also the Historic District Commission. It was a busy week for them. On Tuesday night, a hacker or hackers briefly took over the meeting for about 15 seconds, peppering the online broadcast with racist language and images of a Ku Klux Klan meeting. Whoever did this has not been identified as of yet. The Historic District Commission chairman said that he was going to be reaching out to town administration and the Nantucket Police Department for assistance and to report the incident. It happened about 7:30 on Tuesday night, about 3.5 hours into the meeting, as the town's historic preservation planner was uploading some plans onto Zoom. The hack began with some scribbling on the screen, virtual scribbling. The N-word was posted several times, as well as spoken, and images of a Ku Klux Klan meeting in flames were also put up before the town's public access television station, which runs the Zoom meetings for the town boards and commissions, shut it down. Prior to Tuesday night's hack, access to these Historic District Commission meetings was intentionally easy, required little to no verification in efforts to encourage participation. That's changed. Moving forward, anyone who wants to participate, not just watch, will be required to provide a name and an email address before being admitted. The town's public access station has stronger safeguards in place for meetings where there's more participation, like the select board and the planning board, but the HDC had chosen initially not to go that route, but they've since changed their mind.
That's Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The pandemic has impacted the Cape's elderly, perhaps more so than any other part of the Cape's population, which means it's also impacted caregivers. Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent takes a look at this, and she joins us now. Hi, Casey.
Hi, how are you?
Casey, it seemed that early in the pandemic, this was more of a focus for a lot of people. Your story reminds us that so many of the elder services that people depend on across the region are still in limbo. Tell us a little bit about Bernice Birchman and her son, Howard.
Okay, well, yeah, this really goes on for the elderly who already suffer from isolation and boredom. That's kind of a part of their normal lives. And now with a pandemic, most of their supports and entertainments have really been either shuttered completely or extremely limited. And yeah, I talked to a couple of different people. One is Howard Birchman, who owns the Tucker Inn in Provincetown. And his mom, who's 92, was living in Brewster in Wingate, I believe. No, Maplewood. And she'd been there a few years. And then a nurse, lockdown happened. Her son couldn't see her for a few weeks. And he got a call from her nurse saying she's got shortness of breath. And this, you know, in late March, early April was really alarming. He took her to the hospital, found out she had stage 4 lung cancer. So he couldn't see her. She was taken to a rehab in Chatham, which is also a nursing home, Liberty Commons. And she was there for, I don't know, I forget how much he said, how long he said, but a few weeks, and he couldn't see her. She had to be isolated for 14 days, which is the protocol. And then even after that, he still couldn't visit her. Every time he called, she was asleep. He just had no contact. And the nursing home, he says, was trying to pressure him to put her into hospice. And he said, how can I make such a decision when I can't even see my mom? And so it got worse. He got really scared and really became convinced that she was going to die alone in the nursing home. So he made the decision, which was pretty difficult for a guy without much medical experience, to say, okay, mom, you know, you're going to come to my guest house in Provincetown, and where you can at least die with people around you. And so he did that, and she had a really amazing turnaround, and it turned out to be an incredible story where they're all together and she's been thriving through the summer. But you can see how close it came to going the other way. And I also talked to another woman from Eastham who has been taking care of her mom who has Alzheimer's. Her name's Erica. The mother's name's Erica. Linda Groth is the name of the woman who's taking care of her mom. Anyway, for 12 years, taking care of her mother, for 10 of those years, she's been going to the adult daycare center at the Eastham Senior Center, and that closed, of course. So now for 3 days a week, whereas her mom had entertainment, people to be with, music, programs, pets coming in to visit, all that ended. Linda can only leave her mother alone for half an hour at a time, and she has to figure out what to do at all other times with very limited help and very limited contact from the outside world. So it's really hard. And Melanie Brave, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that this is a strong story that really points to the difficulties of isolation right now, and with the limited amount of support that can be provided to the elderly because and their caregivers because of the pandemic. You can find the story in the Provincetown Independent. Casey Myers, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Someone trying to figure out how much Halloween is happening or isn't happening on Martha's Vineyard might be forgiven for expressing some confusion. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times can perhaps shed some clarity on the subject for us. He joins us now. Hi, George.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yay. I can hear you, George. George, to trick-or-treat or not to trick-or-treat, that's the question here. And actually, there's more to it even than that. Let's start with Vineyard Haven. What's happening? The town is discouraging Halloween celebration. Is that right?
That's right. They initially put out guidance on how to do it following CDC guidelines. But then a pretty popular neighborhood, William Street, it draws about 1,000 people a year. They started saying, yeah, we don't think this is the right year to be doing this. And they said that they were going to donate their stuff to the Island Food Pantry. And so that was a big development. But the town hall isn't holding its open house, and there's other things that are happening that aren't happening, like the parade that traditionally happens in Tisbury. So, and there's also some road construction there, and they're saying – that they weren't able to finish it in time for Halloween. So they really, they're really discouraging people from coming out because there could be trip hazards, the sidewalks aren't finished. It's really not the best time to have trick-or-treating for that reason and COVID.
But Tisbury, just one Vineyard Haven here, just one town. Oak Bluffs is kind of taking a different approach. Is that right?
Well, they had, but we had breaking news yesterday, and that is that they've decided to change course, and they're not going to allow Vineyard Avenue to close. The Board of Health raised some concerns. They had an emergency meeting yesterday with the Board of Selectmen, and so they've said we're not going to allow that road to close, and they're discouraging trick-or-treating now as well. On Circuit Ave, businesses were going to hand out candy, but they're not going to do that anymore. So some big changes that have happened, and, you know, check out our website. We have all the latest on there. You can still trick or treat, you know, in your neighborhood, but they're asking people not to go to these high profile places.
Hmm. I want to ask you about a different story you've got in the paper. It's about a campaign to encourage people to wear masks, and it's an attempt to kind of put a glamorous spin on it, it seems like. It's getting some attention. It's a fun story. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is Amelie Loyotte, and folks on the island would know her as the person who puts out a sea serpent in Farm Pond each summer. Nicknamed Vanessa. And when she came to the island this year, she was a little concerned seeing the number of people who weren't wearing masks. We had stories early on in Oak Bluffs where visitors were starting to come, but they weren't social distancing, they weren't wearing masks. And she saw that story and she said, we have to do something about this. So she got together with the Oak Bluffs Business Association. And they came up with this campaign. They called it the Masquerade. And at first, she had illustrations of a couple of people, and a man and a woman made these posters that said, superheroes wear masks on MV. And those were pretty cool. But then she got together with a local photographer, Jeremy Dreesen, and he does some work for us as well. And Jeremy took these great photographs of people wearing masks on the beach, and the sun is beautiful behind them, setting behind them, and the lighting is just terrific. And Those now say superheroes wear masks on MV, and they're up in storefronts. They're at movie theaters where movie posters would be. The movie theaters on the island have been closed by and large. And so it's just a great campaign. She used her advertising prowess. Jeremy used his photography skills, and Christine Todd used her business acumen to really make this campaign something that really, there was a lot of mask compliance after that in Oak Bluffs. And, you know, you have to give some of the credit to getting this message out.
And the pictures are so much fun. You get to see, I was going to say the faces of some of the faces of Martha's Vineyard, but not the faces particularly, the eyes, the people of the vineyard there, you know, being highlighted in wearing their masks, but looking like so at home and really in possession of the situation instead of being sort of demoralized by wearing a mask.
They really do. I mean, some of them are just so fun, as you said, and a couple of them are wearing capes, too. So our superheroes not only wear capes, but they also wear masks.
That is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Take care, Steve.
A potentially historic nomination this week. Governor Baker announced his pick of someone who could be Massachusetts' first Black and female Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And state lawmakers heard from educators, parents, and advocates this week about how the school year is going so far. CAI's Catherine Ident talked with our State House reporter Mike Dean for an update on these stories. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
The governor nominated Supreme Judicial Court Associate Justice Kimberly Budd to become the highest-ranking jurist in the state this week. Tell us more about who Judge Budd is.
Well, Budd's been on the court since 2016. She was on the Superior Court before that, since 2009. She's a Harvard Law grad. She's actually the daughter of former U.S. Attorney Wayne Budd. She's 54, which means that if she becomes Chief Justice, she'll have quite a long time before that mandatory 70-year-old retirement age that justices have to reach in Massachusetts. Baker selected her as the Associate Justice, like I said, in 2016. Deval Patrick put her on the Superior Court in 2009. She actually succeeded the late Chief Justice Ralph Gantz on the Superior Court back in 2009. So this will be the second time that she stepped up to replace the late Justice Gantz. She said that, you know, she takes the responsibility very seriously. She acknowledges that she would, of course, be the first Black woman to hold the position, only the second Black person and second woman to become the Chief Jurist of Massachusetts, and says that she is focusing on how the court can operate during the pandemic and retaining a lot of the kind of changes and interest in the judicial process and reforms that Justice Gantz had been active in towards the end of his tenure at the top of the court. So now it goes to the 8-member Governor's Council, and they will vet judges. Budd had, I believe, 2 unanimous votes by the Governor's Council for other positions already, so it seems like probably smooth sailing, but there will be a hearing in the coming weeks to see if she formally gets the nod.
Okay, so it seems like things are favorable with the Governor's Council. What else are you hearing in regards to this nomination? Is there praise for this, or are there critics?
There's been very little criticism so far. From what I've seen, fairly unanimous praise from the legal world, as well as the activist world and public policy. A lot of folks have great respect for Budd. They think that she's going to carry on a lot of what Gantz had been building at the SJC, as well as bringing a fresh perspective. One of the main things that she said is that, you know, everyone needs to be listened to, and so she certainly embodies in her legal career and in her background perspectives and points of view that can be valuable for the court to see. Several of those governor's counselors expressed positive, you know, statements about what this vote may look like when Budd comes before them. So it seems like pretty smooth sailing.
In other news, education leaders went before state lawmakers this week to talk about how students are faring in this pandemic. So who was there? Who testified?
So Secretary Jim Pizer and Elementary and Secondary Education Commissioner Jeff Riley, they testified before the Education Committee. So that's the House and Senate members who kind of were doing this series of oversight committee hearings to keep tabs on exactly what's going on with our schools. So there were some broad topics that every witness was asked, and it was about how people are acclimating and adjusting to this kind of system. Not only how is the state making changes to make remote work and semi-remote, sometimes in-person work happen, but also how are families going through it? How are teachers? How are staff? A lot of attention was paid to the learning models. That was a big piece of policy that the state put into effect at Pizer's level that said that school districts needed to have in-person, remote, and hybrid models in place. So now the lawmakers want to know, how are these different models being used? How often are they being used? How many students have been in the classroom most days? How many haven't been in the classrooms at all? That kind of a thing. The most important aspect that they're kind of pushing here at this oversight hearing is, what are the goals for this school year? What does success even look like? Is it days in class? Is it evaluations? You know, they want to know what the status of the MCAS test is. You know, how do we measure the success of these students in a year like this? And what does the state plan to do if rates increase? So these were some of the questions that were asked of the Baker administration, who says they have plans in place. But again, we have many, many different districts who are autonomous and kind of working on their own with the state.
Special needs students have been of particular concern, in large part because they need special types of learning that often require them to be in person with a teacher or an aide. What did they have to tell lawmakers this week?
Of course, yeah, that's one of the biggest downsides to all this remote learning is the kind of very crucial services that special needs students have. Lawmakers are concerned about how many people have access to those services that they rely on. And also they're concerned about students turning 22 and aging out of that special ed system during this pandemic and potentially having to join the workforce or just being stripped of those services that they were getting from schools. So this is something that lawmakers could potentially look at next year as a change in the law to maybe extend that 22 years outward during the pandemic, allow older students to stay in school and have access to those services. And they're really looking at the experience of teachers during this pandemic. One situation that was coming up is, what if a teacher works in a district they don't live in? So their kids are doing, you know, one set of standards and the teacher is having to do another one. There could be some disjointed work there. So they heard from unions on that. So overall, it's a very broad look at how the state is reacting, but it could really factor into what lawmakers decide to do next year if they want to pass some new laws and set down some new guidance.
That's CAI's Statehouse reporter, Mike Dean. Thanks so much, Mike. Have a great weekend.
Great to be with you.
And that is CAI's Morning Edition host, Catherine Iden, speaking with our Statehouse reporter, Mike Dean. That is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton, Noah Asimow at the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle and Denise Coffey from the Cape Cod Times. We heard from Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror and Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. We spoke with George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times and heard there from Mike Dean up at the State House. Big thanks to our Dan Treidel back at the studio. He's making the calls and pushing the buttons that put this show together. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Have a happy, spooky, and safe Halloween. Thank you for listening.